Catamanchi and Mr. Padilla. Am I getting close on your name?
That's perfect, Judge. Catamanchi.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Warden, before you leave, what was the result of the Cobbler defense?
The jury saw through it, Your Honor, and he was...
So we'll see that on appeal, then, I take it.
We'll see the Cobbler.
Look forward to that.
If I can give you real quick further, that defendant had used a very similar tool, but he did actually use the Cobbler shoes. He had evidence that he Cobbler shoes. But he'd been caught using a very similar tool weapon in earlier times.
Thank you. Thank you. This will not come off Mr. Catamanchi's time. All right. But very, very interesting, and thank you, Mr. Warden.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ashwin Catamanchi, and I represent Appellant Charles Porter. At his sentencing hearing, Mr. Porter argued that his brief possession of the firearm was a mitigating factor that merited a lower sentence. His argument was a non-frivolous argument, yet the district court offered no indication that it meaningfully considered the argument. First, Mr. Porter's argument was grounded in legal merit. While this court has said that a district court may reject the defendant's argument that his brief possession of a gun warrants a lower sentence, I cited in my brief an Eighth Circuit case, United States v. Lewis, in which that court, the appellate court, said that the district court may take into account a defendant's brief possession of a firearm as a mitigating factor. So I believe that demonstrates that Mr. Porter's argument was not frivolous. It was an argument that the district court was required to take into account in imposing its sentence. The next issue is whether the district court actually did consider that argument.
I'm having a little trouble with the facts on this, though. Understand, he purchases the gun sort of in between his conviction and sentencing that disqualified him, and he transfers it to the girlfriend. But he's actually living with the girlfriend during that period of time?
Your Honor, the evidence was that he was living in various places, moving around from home to home. He did not have a stable home at that time. He did acknowledge that he spent a few nights at his girlfriend's house.
But the girlfriend had the gun for more than a couple days, didn't she?
The girlfriend had possession of that gun, yes. And officers, in fact, got possession of the gun from the girlfriend.
Right, but she had it for more than just a couple days.
Yes, she had it for
the... And he was in and out of that residence with some regularity during that period of time, right?
Yes, that was acknowledged, Judge. And I think the evidence was that Mr. Porter did not ever seek to handle that firearm or possess that firearm after having transferred it to his girlfriend. And the agent who testified at that sentencing hearing acknowledged that he had no evidence that Mr. Porter ever tried to again possess that gun. So I'm not sure that it's proper for the district court or this court to assume that he had possession of that gun at any point after having briefly possessed it and then transferred it to his girlfriend.
He did have possession immediately after taking delivery from the store, though, right?
Yes, he did, and that was acknowledged. But then 2 days after taking possession of the gun, he did give it up. Now, it appears that the district court reacted to that argument, and it tried to create a factual basis to undermine the argument, but it ultimately ignored the merits of the argument. It questioned...
That's confusing to me. If the court focused in on it, how did the court ignore it?
Your Honor, at the sentencing hearing, the court asked Mr. Porter whether he lived with the girlfriend, and then he said no.
It's very suggestive that he didn't believe it, that the district judge didn't believe that he really had transferred it, that it was readily available to him, that his possession continued on beyond the 2 days.
Well, Your Honor, the court didn't make that finding. The problem in this case is that we simply do not know how the court considered that argument, how the court ultimately found on the merits of that argument.
Well, one might infer some skepticism from the questions that he asked and the follow-ups.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the district court's questions were not answered in the way that the district court had assumed they would be answered, because Mr. Porter, in fact, did not live with his girlfriend for an extended period of time. He was in and out of that home. And the testimony from the agent was that he had no evidence that Mr. Porter ever again tried to possess that gun. And I think the case law is, the Seventh Circuit pattern instruction is that a defendant has to intend to have control over the weapon in order to actually constructively possess that weapon. The weapon simply being in the home is not sufficient to establish that the defendant constructively possessed that weapon. So I don't think the evidence supports the conclusion that he constructively possessed that weapon after having transferred it to the girlfriend. And the testimony from the agent supports Mr. Porter's argument. And the district court, yes, it did question Mr. Porter about that fact, but then it never really considered the merits of the argument. And so I think the problem we have here is that without the district court having commented on the argument, we simply do not know how it ultimately resolved the merits of Mr. Porter's principal non-frivolous argument. And for that reason, we would ask that the court to remand for resentencing.
All right, thank you. Mr. Padilla?
Yes.
Close on that? Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. Nicholas Padilla on behalf of the United States. Government characterizes Mr. Porter's argument at the sentencing hearing much like how it was characterized here today concerning his illegal possession of a firearm. Mr. Porter contended that he deserved a lower sentence because he illegally possessed the firearm only for a brief period of time, that being 2 days, before he transferred the firearm over to his girlfriend, Miss Erica Swopes, and thereafter never possessed it again. First, the government believes the district court did not have to mention anything about Mr. Porter's argument specifically due to this argument being a frivolous argument. Looking at the facts in this case, we have Mr. Porter. He was convicted in state court of a felony on January 21st, 2010, and sentenced to 18 months probation. Approximately 18 days after his sentence in state court, Mr. Porter bought a firearm from a federal licensed firearm dealer for $588. Mr. Porter contends that he kept the firearm for only 2 days before giving it to his girlfriend, Ms. Swopes.
The guidelines have been lower if the plea were taken to the false statement count instead of the possession count?
No, it would not, because he was still a prohibited person at the time that he purchased the firearm. Because he was under indictment for a felony offense.
If the plea had been to the other count, then the guideline would have been the same.
It would have been the same. He would have still been a 14, a prohibited person, illegally possessing a firearm. Mr. Porter contends that he had no access to that firearm once he gave it to his girlfriend due to him at times, I guess, being homeless and not staying there at Ms. Swope's house all the time. But it's the government's belief that when you look at the facts, that Mr. Porter always had full access to this firearm. Once contacted, ATF contacted Mr. Porter once they learned that he illegally purchased and possessed this firearm. Mr. Porter contacted his girlfriend and directed her to turn the firearm over to ATF agents. The following day, Mr. Porter's girlfriend did, in fact, meet with ATF agents and did turn the firearm over to them. Additionally, another aspect would be the character letter that Ms. Swopes sent to the court. It's government's position that this clearly supports the government's belief that Mr. Porter always had access to this firearm. In this letter, Ms. Swopes described how Mr. Porter has taken a role as a father to her three daughters, that she and Mr. Porter have been around each other constantly for the last 3 years. And then Ms. Swopes closed the letter by telling the court that she and her children wished that they could have Mr. Porter back around to put their family together as a whole. It's very hard that when you read the letter that was written by Ms. Swopes to the court that Mr. Porter and Ms. Swopes did not live together during this time period. When you look at the facts, Mr. Porter's argument is really not a mitigating factor that the court needed to consider. It's not as if Mr. Porter turned the firearm over to the police, turned the firearm over to a third person that he had no relationship with, or left it at a house that he didn't even stay at. He in essence, gave the firearm over to, in all practical purposes, his wife, when you look at the relationship. So it's the government's position that Mr. Porter's argument, based on his brief possession and not having full access to that firearm, is clearly without merit, and the district court was not required to consider it. If the court does determine that Mr. Porter's argument is not frivolous, the government believes the court adequately considered Mr. Porter's arguments for a reduced sentence. We do have a statement from the court on pages 26 and 27, where he indicates that he has considered all mitigating and aggravating factors set forth in the party's memoranda and the defendant's request for a sentence outside the advisory guidelines. And he basically indicated that, you know, based on the facts and circumstances, he did not believe the defendant met the requirements, and therefore he declined to give him a reduced sentence. When you look at that general statement and you look at his active participation in the sentencing hearing, government feels that he clearly considered Mr. Porter's argument. The court was actively involved, where he asked questions from both attorneys. He asked questions from Mr. Porter, and he asked questions from the only witness that testified, that being ATF Special Agent Roger Crafton, concerning Mr. Porter's arguments and contentions. Government believes at one point, when you look at the sentencing transcript, pages 15 and 16, where Agent Crafton is testifying, and the district court judge specifically asked him, were they living together? What did your investigation reveal concerning Mr. Porter and Ms. Swope's living together at the time the firearm was turned over? When Agent Crafton testified that he interviewed both and both of them denied living together, the district court found it to be very interesting. He continued to ask defense counsel, and then he continued to ask Mr. Porter to find an answer to whether or not they were living together. Mr. Porter, when asked if he was living with Ms. Swope's at a time the firearm was turned over, initially denied. He lied to the court in saying he wasn't living with her. The district court further pushed additional questions. Well, where were you living then? And then asked him again, were you living with her? At that point, Mr. Porter admitted that he had stayed nights at Mrs. Swope's house when the firearm was there. So when you look at the court's interaction and the court's statements on pages 26 and 27 of the sentencing transcript, as well as later on he's questioning Mr. Porter additional concerning the facts, the government believes that those factors and his knowledge of the nature and circumstances of the case support that the district court did exercise his discretion in sentencing Mr. Porter to a guideline sentence. The government is asking that the court affirm the sentence that was given and find that it's reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Padilla. And Mr. Catamanchi.
Your Honor, while Mr. Porter may have had the power to exercise control over that firearm after having transferred it, he did not have the intention to do so. There was no evidence that he had the intention to do so. Therefore, it cannot be said that he constructively possessed that firearm. The problem in this case is that we don't know how the district court judge ultimately came down on that issue. The court ignored the argument. It offered no comment.
What do you take from the judge's statement after he finally gets your client to admit that he spent nights with the girlfriend, where he said, the judge says, where the gun was, or something to that effect, on page 15 of the transcript? Isn't that an implication by him that he doubted that it was a minimal possession?
I don't know, Judge. I think that the district court judge was trying to create a factual basis for constructive possession. I think that ultimately he did not succeed and then simply ignored the merits of Mr. Porter's principal argument and did not offer any further comment on that issue. I don't think it's fair to imply that may have been the judge's implication, but it was not supported by the evidence. And unless the court has any further questions, I'll rest.
We do not. We thank both counsel for their arguments, and we take Mr. Porter's case under advisement.